newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smugger.
Well, it's the Media Project, our first with a new year coming. I'm Rex Smith, here with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo to talk about what's going on in the media. The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis with some veteran journalists from New York's Capital Region looking at the year just passed and the year ahead. You all doing okay from the season?
Hey, you know, let's talk about what's going to happen going forward. Is the glass half empty, half full, a year out? Where are we going to be next year at this time?
Ooh.
Next year or in 10 years or dare we say 20 years?
Well, yeah, good question.
You know where we're all going to be.
The proverbial we, meaning all you listeners too.
Well, you know, looking at the year that we've just passed, I mean, it is really an abysmal year for truth. PolitiFact said that 2025 was the year of lies because the near constant charges of fake news from a president who makes up stuff all the time has really set the stage for a crisis of credibility in American journalism. And if we don't figure out how to deal with that and to try to reestablish some sense of credibility for the vehicles that carry the journalism, I'm not sure how there's a future for journalistic organizations.
I love the idea of focusing on the consequences of the lies, of looking at a lie like immigrants are eating cats and dogs, and looking at the real world consequences of what that kind of lie does to real people. And people are starting to do that more and more. And they're very readable stories. I just don't think they get the coverage that they need to. Partly, that's because those tend to be local stories, and we're not having the local generation of news like we did 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's hard because what you see is the immediate impact, the story that makes a splash. And then, as you're saying, the consequence is the second day story, and that doesn't get as much attention, right?
And it's second day, third day, 1 month later, 6 months later. And there have been... They're not going to fall into your lap, but there have been stories through the mainstream media that follow up on the consequences of the hatred that is directed toward immigrants, toward the ICE arrests and the deportations. When you see the real people stories about what has happened to real people's specific lives.
Yeah. And it's a hard thing to do because when you have people who believe certain things to be true that are not, that is hard to report on. I'm just thinking of the Farm Belt, for example, where the market for soybeans, America's major export crop, was decimated by the Trump trade war because China cut off all purchases when Donald Trump imposed 40% tariffs on everything out of China. And for American farmers, this was devastating. The price of the crops fell. There was no place to sell them. America gave a $200 billion line of credit to a competing nation, to Argentina, who then immediately sold their own soybeans to China. And so that is really good reporting to point that out, but it doesn't still draw the attention as the initial story, as the president's attack on China, as the president saying tariffs are really a great thing for America.
I still think that bubbles up, though. It's not just the stories that people are reading about that makes that difference. It's their own experiences. And so some of those stories end up getting shared, and then it informs others. But it's the real life experiences that the media, you can catch some of them, like you're saying. That was a really good example. You know, the deportations where citizens are deported or veterans are deported and the parents of veterans are deported. So those real life stories bubble up and they get talked about. It's a slower way to do it than we're used to. But my concern is that the people that are supporters of the administration are not seeing those stories on Fox News.
The soybean farmer, for example, I may have heard one clip of one soybean farmer saying he had trouble figuring out how he was going to afford or how much seed to buy for next year. But I didn't, I may have heard it once, but I didn't hear it all the time. Instead, what I heard way too much was, you know, the political bickering about whether or not the Trump administration was going to come up with a bailout. And again, I think we needed to get more boots on the ground out there in the Midwest and do more of those stories. And then again, I appreciate the concern of reporters going into unknown territory and trying to find a farmer willing to talk to you on the record. Typically, you'll get a farmer served up by a local farm bureau or a local politician. So those stories are difficult, but you need to work hard at that and be out there more than they are.
I think it speaks to the distribution mechanism for journalism, because you know that there is good reporting being done out there across the country in the local area, where if you're the nonprofit newsroom serving Manhattan, Kansas, or Emporia or Garden City, you know, you're the person who actually is in the pharmacy or the farm implement store talking to these guys. And that story needs to find an audience somewhere else. It needs to find the audience elsewhere, so that if you're the Gazette, the Times Union, the Saratogian, you don't have to just take a wire story out of Washington about the farm bill. You can actually take something that talks about the consequences.
You know, as someone who, one of the things I do every morning is search a lot of local newspapers looking for different kinds of stories. And I share the ones that I think are relevant or that aren't getting the kind of exposure they should. Oftentimes, I run into paywalls, and I'm sharing something behind a paywall, and so that good content is not getting disseminated like it should. Now, I understand the business model behind paywalls, but it's an obstacle.
Yes, which is why when I'm searching around the country for stories, lately I've kind of given up on local newspapers for that very reason, and I go to the increasingly thriving ecosystem of nonprofit news sites. The Institute for Nonprofit News actually has sites all over the country and nonprofit newsrooms typically do not have paywalls because they do get some philanthropic support. And I think that's actually part of the real hope for the future of journalism, that these terrific sites, you know, for example, the Daily Catch down in the Hudson Valley is a wonderful, we say down because we're sitting in Albany, but that's an example of a nonprofit newsroom focusing on a local area that, in that case, Red Hook and its environment. And there is local reporting of high quality being done without a paywall in place.
Right. Those nonprofit websites will ask you for money, but it's a brief ask, and they're not hitting you with a lot of banner ads or catfish ads, or
right.
They're not disrupting your learning experience. And so it's getting more and more difficult to find stories that really are out there that are being done and doing my part to spread them. I think anyone who's on social media, if they see a story like this, they need to share it.
Yeah.
And share it carefully. Share a legitimate story. That's part of the issue, too. Is social media, you're absolutely right, is the way that people are getting their news of all ages and especially younger people.
And you hope that news will continue to be available. You'll hope that there's enough support for these nonprofit sites to continue to produce it.
And how are the viewers of these supposed to tell between what's real and what's fake?
You know, I think that the caution I always give is take a breath. Wait a minute. Like when the news surfaced about the Reiner's death, I mean, there was a lot of bad information out there. And what I needed to do was wait before I shared. And an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, it's not going to make a big difference to the people I share with. And I'm waiting for a credible news source who I trust to post information, and then I will share it.
This is why typically the local sites that are nonprofit organizations you can go to and find. I mean, I'm just looking down a list going A to Z. Aspen Journalism in Colorado, Athens County Independent in Ohio, the Atlanta Civic Circle in Atlanta, Georgia, you know, Austin Free Press. And I'm sure I can get to Z somewhere here going down the list. But no, I'm just in Detroit here. But the fact is, these sites exist. And I think that if we take a breath, as you say, and try to find a source for good information in a local place where information is needed, we're going to be a lot better off than simply parroting something that comes across our news feed.
You know, for the future, people talk about the role philanthropy will play going forward. And that's true. It's out there. I worry that that's going to be tapped out at some point, and the readers really need to step up and provide their own support. I mean, the power of average Americans to accomplish either voting for a president or making a movie popular. It also applies to making a media organization successful. If you partake of this, you know, step up and do your part, because philanthropy will only go so far.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And maybe we will come to a point in this country in years to come where we aren't right now, where there will once again be public support for media. Do you think that government will recognize that there needs to be a means of distributing dollars to journalism? Or is that a pipe dream? Or do we even want that?
I have hesitancies about even wanting that, because you don't want to be beholden, and what one giveth, they can taketh away. So I'm not sure that I want to see that happen at all, Rex.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But in its absence, we have private equity. We have these hedge funds who have bought newspapers, including those papers that Barb, you and I edited in Troy, in the Saratogian, and have just stripped them of all their assets so that they're a shadow of what they used to be. So the private sector is not supporting journalism. I guess we have to hope that 15, 20 years from now, we will actually have enough small scale, completely distributed news information network so that reporting can be more or less quickly done by trustworthy folks. I can't imagine how we are going to actually educate the audience of consumers to be able to determine what's real journalism and what is fraudulent.
You know, despite our fascination with AI, I believe that humans are the ones who are going to save the truth, save journalism, because there's nothing like a human brain, the human creative spirit, to ask the inquisitive questions that need to be asked, that bring the caring to a story that needs to be brought, that writes a story with a way that will draw people in and make them engaged in a way that AI slop. At least it hasn't done it so far, and I don't see a promising future for it going forward. I just believe that our credibility rests on the humans being a big part of what we do as the media going forward. AI can be a help, but it does a very poor job of actually reporting and writing the news.
That's absolutely true. And you know, you mentioned earlier about philanthropy, and but we're thinking of that with hope in our hearts that it's philanthropists who want to own news outlets or support news outlets that are going to do a fair and credible and honest job of telling the news and not reporting from a particular viewpoint that may not be honest.
The difficulty is that the journalism that we are accustomed to, which is almost disinterested in the individual enough so that it can be independent, is dying. What people really want is a personal relationship. That's why influencers are so popular, because people can detect their personality. We were trained to kind of get our personality out of our reporting, because that was an interference in fairness and objectivity. It tainted it by having the individual journalist involved. But right now, consumers are voting with their eyeballs for those who inject personality, even if it's not credible, even if it doesn't have the depth of real reporting. And so this again goes back to, I guess, the question of news literacy training or education generally. How do you get people to be able to recognize what is of value? And how do you make sure that that kind of independence isn't being aped by AI? You know, even the current generation of AI is good enough that it can be pretty credible in what it presents.
And when you talk about that, when you listen to, say, stories on the Washington Post, that they'll read you a story times, and this story is being read by an AI voice, by Brian, an AI voice. And I think, why aren't they saying like R2-D2? They're humanizing the voice. Okay,
yeah.
So the source is the credible source of the Washington Post, for instance. But still, you become familiar with the voice, you believe what the voice is saying, and the voice can be a different Brian or Bobby or Darren or whatever from different places, and it sounds trustworthy. And that kind of concerns me. It's you're listening to and they're reading the news that a human has created, though.
You know, these influencers are a little bit a twisted version of our old newspaper columnists who developed an audience who had personality in what they wrote, but they were steeped in basic journalism values. And that is the big distinction going forward. I mean, we found columnists were very popular, and they drew a lot of loyalty to our publication, but it depended on the platform, and the fact that someone was a respected columnist that the Times Union had chosen, for example, brought credibility to them. Today's influencers or podcasters, they build their own brand, and they don't have the surrounding mechanism of journalism to bolster their credibility.
What they have is the value of attention. So we, and this is a point that has been made by a number of experts, we live in an attention economy. And so if people get attention, they can become influencers. As influencers, they can replace journalists. What I hope we can develop as a journalism industry is the capacity to generate attention for serious reporting, for real stuff that matters to people, stuff that has the fairness and accuracy and depth and insight that the best journalism has typically presented. But I don't know that we are yet able to figure out how to deliver that with the kind of attractiveness that some of these influencers have. You know, it's not an accident that Dan Bongino became the deputy director of the FBI because he drew a lot of attention. He was an influencer. He was an online media presence, and Donald Trump noticed him and elevated him to a high position. Since he's failed at the job, he's going back to being an influencer, and no doubt he will be a powerful influencer, but he's not a truth teller. He's not a guy that any one of us would hire as a reporter. And that's, unfortunately, where people's eyeballs are going. What gets our attention gets us. And that, unfortunately, is the peril that journalism confronts, because we're up against a system that really values where the eyeballs go.
You know, we used to be able to do this. The main rule here is not to be boring, but we used to be able to do this with captivating stories accompanied by captivating photographs. I mean, those would draw people into a story and make a real difference. And I still think that has value. I just think it needs to find a new platform, a new way of getting to the people, because I think those stories will resonate. It's just that they're hidden. They're behind a cloud of paywalls and social media algorithms, and they can't bubble to the surface like they should.
Well, and hidden, Barbara, you were making this point just before we started the show about AI summaries. We now have content that ordinarily would have been read by people searching for information that is basically hidden behind a cloud of artificial intelligence, right?
I think there was a recent Pew study that Google users are less likely to click on a link when they encounter the search pages that come with the AI search pages. And I could be partially sometimes guilty of that myself.
Sure.
You're putting in a question like we had not too long ago, and instead of getting your choices of things that you can click on, you're getting those summaries. And I'll usually look at the summary and see if it sounds reasonable for the question that I'm asking. I'm not taking the other leap of going to ChatGPT or one of those sources to try to ask that question. But I will experiment by looking for the links that are being provided with those summaries. And sometimes they're pretty decent and sometimes they're tenuous.
There's the whole additional problem of the politicization of media sources, of people going to that which they like and trust. Speaking of Pew, you know, Pew did research on the different news sources right now for Republicans and Democrats, and found, for example, that Democrats are three times more likely to distrust Fox News than Republicans are. Only 64% of Democrats say we don't trust, or people who lean Democrat, we don't trust Fox News. Only 21% of Republicans distrust Fox News. Whereas CNN, you've got 58% of the Republicans or leaning Republicans who distrust CNN versus the Democrats, only 14%. So again, there's a 400% spread there in which Democrats far more trust CNN. And this kind of thing is repeated throughout the media. People are simply looking to different sources. And if the sources are not likewise trustworthy in their reporting, you're going to get different content entirely.
When I saw that survey and I did look through it, my first reaction was like, so what the heck is new here? You know, the Republicans don't like this one and the Democrats don't like that one. But what was kind of startling was the growth in the distrust of what would be the mainstream sources, the extreme dislike of CNN, which I think has made inroads trying to be more middle ground. So it's still distrusted by the Republican leaning, and the just one-sided listening to the Fox News was just extraordinary, the growth of that.
Can I just say how grateful I am to Pew to do the kind of research they do year in and year out? And the value of it is it gives us trends. And so we can see what's happening and we can do a self-examination and say, well, why is this happening? It's a great resource. It's something journalists tend to turn to a lot, but I would wish the average people would go there and wander through some of those very good research studies about what's happening with the media. And they do a bunch of other kinds of research too, but it's a great resource that we should use.
Yeah, it is. It's a great thing. And I think journalists make use of it all the time because it helps us to perceive what we ought to be reporting on. It's very useful.
And when Pew reports, it's more expansive than just about media. When they're talking about beliefs in vaccinations, for instance, and they're comparing it to political leanings, that you're finding that the source of news that you're listening to affirms your beliefs or does it create your beliefs?
And it's credible. That's the thing. It shows you how it's done its research and it's information you can take to the bank. You know, it's in this world where so many things we don't believe that we suspect may be AI generated. If you go to Pew, you can believe that the survey they have done have followed basic statistical models and is something we can trust.
You know, one of the difficulties that the journalists of today and tomorrow are confronting is that people don't know what they don't know, and there is no longer sort of a central sensibility about journalism to give people the information they need. And by that, I mean, we grew up in a journalism environment in which certain things were considered to be important stories. If the Congress was considering a big piece of legislation, or if there was something that really mattered economically, all of the major news organizations would be covering that, and the country would know about it. And nowadays, there are entire hugely important topics that media sources that people trust and look at all the time simply don't cover them. The controversy, the pushback, for example, about the troops in the streets in American cities is not something that Fox News is covering. And the controversy about the American military blowing people out of the water in a second strike is getting very little attention on Fox News in the sense of people understanding the pushback. Whereas I could argue that some of the intense focus on immigration that elected Donald Trump to the presidency was fueled by Fox News relentlessly pushing that issue day after day, as though it was the most important threat to America, as though there really were murderers, rapists, and people being released from mental hospitals intentionally coming into America, as Donald Trump falsely alleged. So it's just difficult these days when there's so many ways for people to get information, and so few of those information sources are really dedicated to trustworthy information presentation.
Yeah, the power of the media is more than how you cover something. It's what you decide to cover. And if you have a platform, you have a responsibility to use it responsibly. And that doesn't always happen. I mean, even at the local newspaper level, what we decided to cover was a decision we made every day. And there were 1,000 stories in the big city every day, and we had to make a decision every night.
And dozens in even the little cities. Absolutely, we did. And it's going to be a difficult thing that as the years to come, you know, we're probably going to have information all around us. Some people say, yeah, we'll get a chip implanted that will actually deliver news to us constantly.
There's that side of it. And I'm worried that after the apocalypse, we're going to be reporting the news on stone with chalk.
Yeah. Let's hope it doesn't come soon. All right, folks, that's the end of the show for this week, our sort of outlook show for the year, in some cases the decades to come, and our gratitude to you for being with us on The Media Project, this show that has now existed for more than 30 years on WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, and we are always grateful to our listeners. You can share your thoughts at media@wamc.org and let us know what you think. We're grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina, for making this possible. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week on The Media Project.
She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's aunt. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.